If you work anywhere near automotive materials, you know the holy grail we're all chasing.
Oh, yeah.
It's that sweet spot. You need a material that's incredibly formable when you're stamping parts.
But then turns into a fortress during a crash.
Exactly. And while advanced high-strength steels have been a huge leap forward, there's this ghost in the machine that keeps engineers up at night.
You're talking about thermal stability.
I am.
You spent all this time and money designing a perfect complex microstructure, and then what's the first thing you do?
You send it down a paint line and you bake it.
You bake it, you heat it up, and that's the conflict we're getting into today.
It is. We are doing a deep dive into a PhD dissertation from Cambridge University by Arijit Saha Potter.
It's a great one.
The title is, and bear with me, Tempering of a Mixture of Bainite and Retained Austenite.
Right.
And while that sounds, incredibly dense,
It does.
it's actually tackling a massive blind spot in how we process these crucial trip-assisted steels.
It really is. The industry loves bainitic steels because of the TRIP effect.
Transformation-induced plasticity.
Yep. But Potter is asking the really uncomfortable question: what actually happens to that carefully engineered architecture when we subject it to something like galvannealing or paint baking?
Because if you cook the magic out of the steel.
You just have expensive brittle metal. All that work is for nothing.
Okay, so before we get to the cooking part, let's set the stage. What is the material? We're talking about carbide-free bainite.
Right. And most listeners will know bainite as that microstructure that forms, between the perlite and martensite temperature ranges.
But Potter spends a good bit of time on how it forms because there's a real debate there.
There is a debate. You had the diffusional camp and the displacive camp.
Okay.
The diffusional argument is that atoms just move randomly, like a crowd dispersing, and eventually find their new home in the lattice.
But that's not the modern view, is it?
No. Potter and most of the evidence now points to displacive theory.
Which is a sheer mechanism.
It's a shear mechanism. It's not a chaotic shuffle. It's more like a coordinated military shift.
An interesting analogy.
Well, the atoms move in a really disciplined way, maintaining their relative positions while shifting the whole crystal structure. And this matters.
Why?
Because that shearing motion causes intense plastic deformation in the parent austenite.
Which in turn generates
A
dislocations.
massive number of them. And we all know what a high dislocation density does.
It blocks slip systems, it makes the material strong.
That's where bainite gets its incredible yield strength. It's not just the chemistry, it's the trauma of its own birth, so to speak.
So we have the strong dislocation-heavy ferrite, but the carbide-free part is the real trick here.
It's the whole point.
Normally, steel in that temperature range wants to precipitate carbon out as cementite.
Which, brittle. It's a crack initiator. You don't want it.
So how do we stop it?
Silicon. That's the hero of the story. Potter uses a high silicon recipe, around 2 weight percent.
And silicon just doesn't like cementite.
It's insoluble in it, so it effectively arrests carbide precipitation. It just stops it from forming and forces the carbon to stay in solution.
Okay, but the carbon has to go somewhere. Ferrite has almost no solubility for carbon.
So it partitions, it gets rejected from the growing ferrite plates, and it piles up in whatever austenite is left over.
Ah, so the remaining austenite gets richer and richer in carbon.
Until it becomes chemically stable, even at room temperature. And this is the whole key. It leads to what the source calls the incomplete reaction
Is the
phenomenon.
reaction just
Stops. It stops before all the austenite is consumed. It hits what's called a T0 curve.
Let's pause on the T0 curve because that's a concept that gets thrown around a lot.
Think of it as a thermodynamic brick wall. It's the line on the phase diagram where the free energy of the ferrite and the austenite are equal for that specific composition.
So once the carbon concentration in the austenite hits that curve,
The driving force for the transformation just vanishes. Poof, growth stops.
and you're left with this composite material, you have your tough bainitic ferrite plates, and trapped between them is this carbon-enriched retained austenite.
Exactly. And this is where the shape of that austenite becomes the single most important factor for safety.
Right, Potter makes a huge distinction between films and blocks.
It's a vital distinction. The films are these thin layers of austenite trapped between the ferrite plates. They're mechanically stable. They are the good guys.
In the
The
blocks.
blocks are coarser regions found between the bigger sheaves of bainite, and they are a liability, a huge one.
Because they're unstable.
Precisely. Under stress, or sometimes just during cooling, those blocky regions will transform into high-carbon martensite.
An untempered high carbon martensite is basically glass.
It's basically glass. It cracks immediately. So for good toughness, you need a film-to-block ratio that's as high as you can get it. Ideally, over 0.9.
So we want the films, we hate the blocks. And the whole reason we even want these austenite films in the first place is for the Tri-P effect.
The magic ingredient.
When a car crashes, that retained austenite transforms into super hard martensite during the deformation.
Right when you need it most. It absorbs a huge amount of energy and hardens the material at the same time.
It's like an intelligent steel. It adapts to the load.
That's a good way to put it.
But here's the problem Potter set out to solve. We make this perfect microstructure. Then we have to prevent rust, so we galvanneal it.
We heat it to 450, maybe 500 degrees Celsius.
Or it's an engine part that sees 400 degrees in service. What happens to our carefully balanced, metastable austenite?
That is the big gap in the literature he was trying to fill. We know how fresh martensite tempers.
Sure, it spits out carbides, it softens.
But bainite is different because it kind of auto-tempers as it forms, so reheating it, the kinetics are murky. Does the austenite decompose? And if it does, what does it turn into?
Because if it decomposes, you lose the Tri-P effect. Your safety feature is gone.
Or worse, you might create those brittle carbides we tried so hard to avoid in the first place.
So Potter's mission was to map this decomposition. And the experimental toolbox he used is, well, it's a masterclass in modern characterization.
Oh, absolutely. He didn't just toss samples in a furnace. He used a thermic master.
A thermomechanical simulator.
Which lets you replicate the exact thermal and mechanical history of a production line. The rolling, the cooling, the reheating, all while you're measuring the sample.
And he coupled that with dilatometry, which is one of my favorite words.
It's a good one.
It just measures the tiny changes in volume of the sample. Austenite is denser than ferrit, right?
Right. So any phase change shows up as a little wiggle on the volume curve.
But dilatometry is a blunt instrument. It tells you something changed, but not what or how much.
Exactly. And that's where he brings in the heavy artillery, X-ray diffraction, specifically using Rietveld refinement.
Why Rietveld specifically? Why not just a standard peak integration?
Because in these complex microstructures, the peaks all overlap. The ferrit peak and the martensite peak are practically sitting on top of each other.
A standard method just gives you a guess.
It really does. Rietveld refinement uses this complex algorithm to fit the entire pattern, every peak, every background, wiggle to a theoretical model. It's the only way to get a precise quantitative fraction of the retained austenite.
Which he needed because he was tracking really small changes over time.
And then on top of that, he used TEM to actually see the films, which are just nanometers thick. And maybe most impressively,
the synchrotron.
He used in situ synchrotron X-ray radiation.
It feels like bringing a cannon to a knife fight for a car part, doesn't it?
It does, until you realize how fast these reactions happen. A standard lab X-ray might take minutes for one scan.
By then, the reaction is over.
It's long over. A synchrotron gives you such a high flux of photons that you can get a full diffraction pattern in milliseconds. You can literally watch the crystals change in real time as you hold the temperature.
It's like watching a movie of the atoms. Okay, so he has the tools. He has two alloys, a manganese silicon mix and a nickel silicon one. He puts them through these tempering cycles. What was the theory supposed to predict?
Well, the classic model for this is the Johnson-Mayle-Avrami-Kolmogorov equation.
The Avrami equation, the S-curve.
Classic S-curve for phase transformation, yeah. But you have to pair it with something like the Zener model for diffusion-controlled growth. The assumption was that the whole process is limited by how fast carbon can get out of the way.
Which brings up the idea of impingement.
Yes. As the ferrite grows into the austenite, the grains start to interfere with each other. There's hard impingement when they physically touch and stop.
But Potter was more focused on soft impingement.
Right. This is where the diffusion fields overlap. So the carbon piling up ahead of one growing plate runs into the carbon piling up from another.
And the concentration gradient just flattens out.
It flattens out and growth slows to a crawl. It's like traffic congestion slowing everyone down long before the cars actually touch bumpers.
That is a perfect analogy.
It's all about traffic management for carbon atoms.
So let's get to the climax, the key findings. What actually kills the retained austenite when you heat it up?
This is where it gets really interesting. There were two major findings, and one of them is a bit of a plot twist.
Okay.
The first is the mechanism. It turns out the decomposition isn't driven by the nucleation of new ferrite or perlite.
So it's not a new birth?
No. It's the thickening of the existing bainitic ferrite plates. The plates that are already there just start eating away at the austenite films between them.
The walls are closing in.
Literally. But it was the second finding, the one about cooling, that really surprised me.
This is the one that matters for the industry.
This is the critical insight.
Right.
Potter found that in many cases, the austenite doesn't decompose while it's sitting there at, say, 400 Celsius. It survives the oven.
So you take the part out, you check it, you think you're safe.
You think you're totally safe. But what the tempering process did was subtly change the chemical stability of that austenite. It conditioned it.
Oh.
So as the part cools down to room temperature after the heat treatment, that's when the austenite becomes unstable and snaps into martensite.
That is insidious. It's a delayed failure mechanism.
It's incredibly insidious. The heat doesn't kill it directly. It just weakens its immune system so the cooling can finish it off.
Wow. So it raises the martensite's start temperature.
Exactly. So instead of staying austenite all the way down to room temp, it suddenly decides to transform at, say, 100 degrees C on the way down.
And you end up with fresh, brittle martensite in your final part, even though your in-process checks showed everything was fine.
It completely changes how you have to design these heat treatments. You can't just look at the soap time and temp. You have to model the stability on cooling.
It adds a whole new boundary condition for the process engineers.
A very important one.
And did the alloy choice matter? The manganese versus the nickel?
It did.
Yeah.
Significantly. The nickel-silicon alloy tempered much, much faster than the manganese-silicon one.
So nickel accelerated the decomposition.
It did. Which is a bit counterintuitive, because we usually think of nickel as an austenite stabilizer.
In terms of phase equilibrium, sure.
But for the kinetics of this specific decomposition, it acted as an accelerator. Which means, if you're designing a part that needs galvanizing, you might want to lean away from high nickel chemistries to give yourself a bigger, safer processing window.
So let's zoom out. From the atomic lattice to the assembly line, what's the so what here? Why does this matter to an engineer listening right now?
It matters because it moves us from trial and error.
To predictive design.
Exactly. We aren't just crossing our fingers and hoping the paint bake doesn't ruin the crash safety. Potter's work gives us the kinetic models, the actual numbers for that Avrami equation, to calculate precisely how much austenite will survive a given thermal cycle.
It lets us push the limits safely. We can design lighter cars because we can trust the material's strength, knowing we haven't accidentally compromised it during manufacturing.
And that leads directly to better fuel efficiency and, more importantly, better safety. It's a straight line from Rietveld refinement to saving lives on the highway.
It really does highlight the invisible architecture we all rely on, doesn't it?
It really does.
Every time you get in your car, you are trusting your life to a microscopic crystal of austenite that's fighting this desperate thermodynamic battle not to turn into something brittle.
And as Potter showed, the margin between a stable safety feature and brittle failure can be incredibly narrow.
Mm.
And it can be crossed on the cooldown when you think the danger is past.
It makes you wonder, are we getting close to the theoretical limit of what we can ask steel to do?
We might be. But as long as we can understand and control the atoms this precisely, I think there's still a bit more room to maneuver.
That's a comforting thought. We'll leave it there for this deep dive. Thanks for listening.